Hey everybody, this is Matilda Solano from Black and Brown in Bioethics, and you are listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast, the show that gets together with academics to question academic hierarchies, structures, and conventions, unpack their inherent issues, and find solutions together. We have a bonus episode for you. This area of power and privilege in academia is so vast and extends beyond some of the areas we've already covered. We initially recorded the episodes in 2023, and the bonus episodes were recorded a year later. So in this bonus episode in the Power and Privilege series, this is with Clinical Associate Professor Eleanor Fleming. Eleanor is a public health dentist and assistant dean for Equity, Diversity and Inclusion at the University of Maryland School of Dentistry in West Baltimore in the United States. Her research examines how dentistry as a clinical and academic practice and research enterprise can be anti-racist. In this episode, we will discuss the untold histories and how legacies can be connected with identities in the present.
Very excited to have you on our podcast, and I'm so happy we could do a bonus podcast with you, Eleanor. I just want everybody to know all about you and how wonderful you are. So please, can you just introduce yourself and also your interest on kind of power and privilege in academia and why you were interested in doing this podcast?
Sure. So Eleanor Fleming, she, her pronouns. I have interdisciplinary background, a PhD in political science, dental degree, so licensed practicing, well, licensed to practice dentistry. I don't do clinical dentistry in the way that we traditionally think of it. And then additionally, training in epidemiology. So my lens through which to think about power and privilege comes through, you know, both looking at systems through like policy, politics lens, social science background, but also in seeing the impact through a public health practice and the inequities that are faced by typically minoritized populations in oral health. So my sense of the world is one of questioning and always seeing the interplay of systems, structures, policies that will always have some type of power dynamic. And also being very attentive to in dentistry, which is a very privileged healthcare providing profession, the ways in which privilege shows up into who is able to join the workforce, who is able to become a faculty member, who is able to become a researcher, and how that who drives the what and the outputs. And part of what I try to do with my scholarship and advocacy in many respects is to ensure that we are talking about power and privilege, which in oral health, we often do not do especially great jobs about that, but also looking for solutions in order to create opportunities for people who have the skills and the passion to want to be a part of the solutions around inequities, but also doing it in a way that, again, helps to decenter that power, because now the point of interest becomes how do you elevate community voices and make sure that those most affected by the problems are able to inform the interventions and the solutions, which again means another kind of distribution of power and acknowledgement of, you know, even the privilege of being in the academy and what that means for who sets the research agenda and kind of what are the questions that we even ask. So I think from a professional training perspective, you know, that is who I am in terms of as an individual. I mean, I'm zooming in from West Baltimore, here in Maryland in the United States. Baltimore is the third largest majority Black city in this country. It is a city that is both Southern, that has the built-in social determinants of health, of, you know, housing redlining, of histories of enslavement, of police violence, of all of the things that we often think of urban places in the United States. And so living in this place and being a part of a very rich and resilient community also informs how I ask questions and try to go about, again, the work of scientific inquiry. So that's who I am.
I was really lucky to kind of listen to you when you were at the University of Bristol recently, and I was struck by the pictures that you presented of the first African American male dentist and female dentist. And when the slide came up with the first Black British male dentist, and there was nothing, no record for the first Black British female dentist, it's something I had never even thought about. I'd never even been struck by the fact that dentistry is actually considered a very white profession, even by the fact you showed us on Google when you were Googling it, who was coming up. What made you start gathering the courage to start telling these stories and collecting these memories?
So, that is an excellent question. And I think my approach to this work, again, comes from lived experience. So, my undergraduate degree is in African American studies. And I am lucky enough to have been trained by amazing African American historians who taught me the value of knowing histories and also being willing to tell those stories of histories. And, certainly in British and American contexts, like we can name like whatever the first are. And typically those first are white men, right? And then sometimes we can name the first who are white women, and maybe sometimes it's like some other, but this sense of like who the first are who look like me just becomes very critical to how I see myself as a professional. In addition, I trained at a historically Black college, Meharry Medical College, which is one of two historically Black dental schools in the United States that are still functioning and training the majority of Black dentists in the United States. Being trained in a historically Black college or university, whether as a professional student or undergrad, you're taught your history, right? You're taught the founding of the institutions. You're taught the giants who either graduated from your school or contributed in meaningful ways. So since becoming a dental student in 2007, that dental history has always been very much alive and present to me. And it was striking in 2020 when I made a pivot into academia and started, asking these questions, asking the quiet questions out loud about structural and systemic racism, its impact on oral health, its impact on oral health resource, re the its impact on the oral health workforce, and seeing that we don't say these names. And so one of the things that I was intentional about, and I'll just let you see my what I use for who I am on Zoom when my camera is off, and that's Dr. Ida Gray, who was the first Black woman dentist in the United States, trained at the University of Michigan from Clarksville, Tennessee, which is near where I'm from. And so I took it as this is how I'm going to show up in these spaces, always saying the names. Always making sure that we are aware, whether it's we as Black people, we as dental public health folks, we as dentists, whoever the we is, you're going to leave knowing something about dentistry and how I understand the history. And hopefully, you will be curious enough to ask the question, like, why didn't I know that? And also, depending upon your specialty or your practice, to find out who those first are. Because in doing, a bit of research for Black History Month celebrations, which we have in February, there is a very rich history of unnamed people in dentistry who happen to be Black. And the degree to which we do not tell those stories of both their courage, their fortitude, their innovation, and what they brought to clinical practice and community practice, like, shame on us for not doing that. Because if we believe that where we learned our best lessons is from the past, we have a cadre of unknown folks or names that we don't elevate enough who can show us what a path should look like. And so I feel like that's what I try to do in using those images and saying those names.
think one of the things I've started to think about with history more and more is that there's all these famous figures that you can name, and a lot of the famous figures, as you mentioned, never really look like us. And one of my friends told me about a poet or a saying that she knows, and it's where you never really die until the last living person forgets who you are, which, you have people like Julius Caesar, Cleopatra, who technically, I guess, would have been alive for over 2,000 years because their stories are still being told today. And what do you think the value is in preserving these histories and telling these stories?
Historic preservation in a concrete sense of how do we save spaces and make sure that those spaces have the appropriate public histories. So even in London, I've been following on LinkedIn efforts in the city to have a artistic, historically informed public space that tells histories around enslavement, Black British experiences, and kind of seeing the care and the efforts that the city has seemingly gone to in, selecting artists, having these, public spaces where you can vote. And yes, I did vote on my favorite. Like, that is important because that is in many respects how we remember history. Like, you will forget, unfortunately, a lot of what you maybe learn in a class, but when you see it in public spaces, when you have that reminder in a lecture, when you kind of have the space like the podcast to be reminded of these places, these people, these events that happen, I hope that it would spark us to see ourselves in that continuum of space and time and to have a better sense of how we are essentially the inheritance of their work. So, like, we're running a relay race, like, we have the baton, and now we got to run the next leg of the race to get it to the next person. And, I think that we do a great job of this work in community. So, in Baltimore, there are so many efforts around preserving histories of neighborhoods, of, famous figures, of even not so famous figures who had tremendous impacts on community. And so you see this in community spaces. In fact, there's a whole history in Africa of the storytellers, the gyros. I think that's how you say it. My pronunciation is never quite right, but Gritos, who were the storytellers in, Mali and West African civilizations and kingdoms, who their task was to be the rememberers, was to tell the stories. And so for us in professional spaces, especially in scientific and research spaces, we owe it to ourselves to both know those pasts, but also to be the inheritors of keeping those stories alive. Because if we don't, people will forget Ida Gray, and they will tell some story that, oh, Black women have never been in dentistry. There's no need to really be inclusive. Like, it's only been these people. But it's like, no, there are these histories of people who have done these things. And it's incumbent upon us to continue those traditions of the work and the effort, but also in reminding ourselves of those stories of resilience so we have what we need to keep going.
And I think there's a lot to say about the way modern medicine is done because, and dentistry, because a lot of it still rely, a lot of people still talk about the Hippocratic Oath. And how do you think these kind of legacies influence how people of color are actually treated in healthcare and in academia today?
So again, another powerful and very relevant question. So now I'm thinking of, maternal health and maternal morbidity and mortality here in the United States. And if I'm following what I'm reading coming from the UK, there's a similar problem. So what is the problem? Black pregnant people are dying more than non-Black pregnant people, and it's a problem. And the problem is not the Black pregnant people, right? It's the healthcare delivery system. And in the United States, again, going back to times of enslavement, you had this workforce of women who were midwives. who did the work of supporting pregnant people in births that were surprisingly safe, right? Surprisingly, people just weren't like dropping like flies. But through modernity and how we think about medicine and who should be able to do particular types of work and who gets the license and who gets the foot in the door, there's been this great erasure of Black midwives. And to the degree that now realizing what a sentinel problem this is, and I'm using the term sentinel to say, like, this is a public health emergency. The healthcare systems have failed people. And so now we're the canaries in the coal mines ringing the alarm. What are payers and systems looking to do? Bring back midwives, bring back doulas, bring back people who look like community members to deliver care in culturally and community appropriate ways that folks need. There's a great body of literature that shows throughout many phases of medicine, so whether it's internal medicine or reproductive health, that Black people, minoritized people, do better when they have providers where there is this thing known as concordance. And so, to the degree that we acknowledge that we've got two problems, like one, people are doing, Black people, brown people are doing better with Black and brown physicians, dentists, other types of healthcare providers, and we know that there are not enough of them. So that's one part of the problem. And then the second part of the problem is that the majority of providers, typically who are white, are not doing this work well and doing it in ways that are actually harming and killing people. So how can you attack this problem with innovative solutions to make sure that there is equity? Because there is no reason in the world that any pregnant person in resource-rich countries like the UK, like the US, should be dying while giving birth. But that should be something that we all just kind of take a pause on and say, like, what is happening? We need to make sure that just from a able to do a thing, give birth, there is safety. But we know that that doesn't exist. And so I think, again, looking back at the history and seeing how care was delivered in community, again, thinking about midwives, seeing, funding and more attention being given to namely Black doulas, but also, other minoritized healthcare workers who can operate in this space of not being the nurse or the doctor, but in this kind of mid-level provider range, like that has to be where we focus for equity. And again, history gives this reason why we're doing this, because it worked in the past.
I'm just thinking of these histories and where we are today and your identity and who you are. How is this kind of inspiring you to carry on doing what you're doing? And what do you want your legacy to be?
So that is another great question. If I'm brutally honest with you and just being transparent, I hope my legacy is one where people can say, like, she tried. Like, she showed up and she tried to do the thing. I don't live in any, false sense of the world that, like, as one person, one Black woman, I'm gonna be able to wave the magic wand and allow for the realization of health justice, but I can do my part. And I hope that in the impact that I'm hopefully having in scholarship, in the scientific journals, of saying the thing and saying the thing with evidence, because that's always the thing. Like, what do you mean this racism? Like, what do you mean these histories? Like, that didn't really happen, did it? And so when I bring the receipts that show, like, yes, it happened, you can go back to these primary sources and do your own reading if you don't want to trust me. But to be able to bring this to the point of science, and are we, again, asking the right questions? Are we looking at root causes that often are going to be at the level of oppressions? And the multiple oppressions that people live with in intersecting ways. And I think the other bit of it is how does that all then get translated into better practices? So whether it is workforce diversity, whether it is supporting, dentists, again, often non-minoritized dentists and better practices, whether it's trauma-informed care, whether it is cultural humility, empathy, like all of the things that we would hope people would bring to serving people, helping to support and that part of workforce and professional development. And then the other bit of it, which again, I continue to go back to, is what does this mean for community? How will this translate into better outcomes for my neighbors? Because my neighbors need to be left alone, right? On the one hand, because it's not like these systems are going to come in and save the day. So a lot of what we need to appreciate, and I think in terms of a legacy, is also helping folks to understand that we need to take strength-based approaches to seeing people. And just because I may not show up or my neighbors may not show up with a PhD and, all of the traditional social capital that we would look to say, like, this is someone who can have optimal health. They may live in a multi-generational home, work, barely with a living wage, but they have the support that they need to survive. And with recognizing that ability for folks to survive and thrive, what can we also learn so that we're not coming in and saying, you need oral health literacy. You just don't understand the value of brushing your teeth twice a day. No, they get it. Life just be lifing. And sometimes you have to make choices between do I pay for the thousands of dollars of dental care that I probably need, or do I pay for rent? And to the degree that we are willing in these spaces to understand the reality of people and life and to allow that to inform how we deliver care with community. And not just think that we're just going to come in and give care that community won't take. Like that, I think, if there's anything that I could inform as a legacy, I would like it to be said that Eleanor helped oral health to get back to the importance of health, people, and community. That, I think, would be a career well practiced.
I really like that. I love that concept as well of care and community, and how you mentioned that it's not just an individual doing one thing, but it's us as a collective doing something, which also still plays into how a lot of these like histories and narratives and legacies played out. It wasn't really just like one individual. It's kind of a collective as well. So I think that notion of being able to do that would make such a big difference. Would there be something that you think the academic community could also do to contribute to changing things?
Yeah, I know. And that is the question that I think about now in my new role, new professional role as the Director of Oral Health Equity Research and Innovation, is what is the role and responsibility of academic spaces? And how can academic spaces, given that there is this academic industrial complex, work in a way to do less harm to community, but also, or maybe, and also to make sure that the scientific work that is done is work that communities actually need. So, as researchers, are we, setting an agenda, a research agenda with community members? Right? Do we even know who our community members are? Which I continue to be shocked at. People who are experts in spaces, and you ask them about, the neighborhood surrounding their institution, and they just like shrug their shoulders as though what they're doing, especially in a public health field, doesn't touch what's across the street from them. So I think for academicians, for clinician scientists, for researchers, like actually go outside. go outside and pay it. Note what you see. Note what you see in your own backyard. Because my grandmother taught me that we can't go out and fix the world if we don't take care of home. And so, to the degree that as scientists, as researchers, as clinicians, we see ourselves based in community. And that is not the notion that modernity, that medicine and dentistry ever teach us, right? You're supposed to be the professional that's like up here somewhere. And then there's like this othering of like community over there, but the two don't come together. So what would it mean for the academician, the researcher, the clinician, scientist to see themselves as a part of a community? And especially if their science is supposed to address disparities, improve outcomes, advance equity. What does it mean to see yourself as a part of a community that probably is different from you, that may be minoritized in ways that you aren't, and to do that work in a collaborative way so that then we have that translation of the science to practice? Because we started from a foundation of the two being in lockstep together and not the scientists over here and the community members like far over there. And we don't create space for collaboration, for listening, for trusting that communities know. And again, this is often very, I'm thinking about this from a particular Black Afrocentric perspective, but you can see this in other communities that sometimes aren't your traditional Western, that this is the norm. It's not the individual, it is the community. So, how can we move from I am the scientist doing the scientific inquiry to we are a collective doing work that hopefully will impact and improve conditions for all of us? And not just, I get the publication, I get the next research grant, I get the next promotion. That I think is the mindset shift that should happen. And hopefully, with the pandemics that we're seeing around COVID, around racism, around now MPOX, the violence, and what we're witnessing in the Mid East and other parts of the world are reminding us that there is not a whole lot of distance between us, and there's more in common than what we see as different. So why not see ourselves as a we, as an us, and not as a me and an I?
And I think that's a great place for us to end and leave it on. Thank you so much, Eleanor. This has been so lovely, so great talking to you, and I'm really happy that we got to meet each other.
So happy, and thank you for being so supportive of my voice and my ideas, because often folks like us don't get the platform to share where we have the passions and the expertise. So thank you for creating the space for these conversations, because if we're not doing it for us, 9 times out of 10, nobody else is. So kudos, and again, thank you. Thank you for creating this platform.
In today's podcast, we talked about legacies, narratives, and identity, Eleanor's experiences in dentistry and academia, the value of preserving history, and the impact of legacies. I liked how Eleanor discussed what she would like her legacy to be. I think it's a difficult question, and it was good to talk about academic dentistry, designing public spaces to hold a retelling of histories. I really think I should find out about this exhibition in London and try and attend it at some point. Thanks for listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast, brought to you by Black and Brown in Bioethics. Be sure to visit blackbrownbioethics.blogs.bristol.ac.uk to listen to more of our podcasts, follow our work, and connect with our network. Credits. Thank you to the Centre for Ethics in Medicine at the University of Bristol and to the EFOX Centre at the University of Oxford for all their support. Thank you to Dr. Kasim Ashraf for providing intro and outro beats.